Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we want to revisit the inflation question here today. We just had release of the Consumer Price Index data for the month of November, and it deserves an inspection. Let's unpack it, right? And try to understand, is inflation accelerating? What are the causes? Supply, demand, something else? Or is it stabilizing and abating? Is it transitory, the increase in inflation that the Fed has been saying all along, but now is beginning to reconsider? What is transitory? Is it a couple months? What is it? Well, the Fed has been saying it's a 2-3 months, it's going to abate here, and then the 2-3 months pass, and they say, oh, it's going to abate, and they just keep the goalposts moving. I don't think it's going to abate. I think what we've got in terms of inflation is something more chronic. It's not going to abate significantly for some time, and that's because we have a fundamental change in the structure of the economy coming out of COVID, although we're not coming out of it very fast. It keeps coming back, but that's another question. But we got fundamental change in what's called the product markets, you know, the things you buy, including services. We call those the product markets. Just as we've seen now, we have a fundamental changes having occurred because of COVID, the recession the last 18 months, in the labor markets. We know that workers are just not coming back. Something structurally has occurred there. And they're demanding more wages, both the unionized and non-unionized, and getting them. Something fundamental has happened to the labor markets. Well, something fundamental has happened to the financial market. I mean, product markets. The other group of markets is what we call financial markets. So that does not show up, financial markets. In other words, stocks and bonds and so forth, inflation, which is really going through the roof, right? That does not show up in the consumer price index. That's the CPI, Consumer Price Index, is only about real goods, real services, okay? So we'll put that away, but yeah, we got runaway inflation going on there, reflected in the bubbles in those markets, but that's another question. And we're looking at goods and services markets here, right? And the question is it temporary? No, it's not. Reflecting a fundamental restructuring of the economy, U.S. and global, by the way, that's going on here. And economists and mainstream media haven't really picked that up and discussed that much. They think we're going back to the old normal. Well, in so many ways, the old normal is no longer normal. It's gone. And coming out of this COVID-induced, accelerated, but not fundamentally caused, recession that we've had, that in my view, we're still in. Let's digress. Why are we still in it? Well, you know, they say we're back to levels of GDP in production that we had before the crash. Well, not in the labor market, you're not, right? And GDP is not a really accurate reflection of the state and condition of the economy. You know, they say that the recession is over once it stops falling. Yeah, we're doing a little explanation of GDP here. I've got off on a digression here, but let's complete it. We've got the end of recession when it stops crashing. You know, the end should be when you're back to where you were. Okay, recently we've just almost attained a recovery. So the recession should really be 18 months. But no, they said the recession is only 3 months because we stopped falling in the summer of 2020. It's taken over a year to claw back to try to climb back to where we were. Oh, but that's not part of the recession. That's just the way, the oxymoronic way they define a recession. They, meaning the government and the economists. I've always had issue with that. Recession should be over when you're back to where you were before you fell. No, it's only when you stop falling. Okay, so just consider that. And we've got problems with how we define and calculate inflation, as well as problems with how we define GDP and recessions. And that's more what we're talking about here today. Let's talk about that. So we got these CPI numbers, consumer inflation numbers. And there's two of them. One is called the CPI for all urban centers, and the other is CPI for wage earners. CPI-U, CPI-W, okay? Now, CPI itself is not an indicator of inflation. It's an indicator of the cost of living in urban centers, okay? There's the difference. All right, it's a, to some extent, a technical difference, but there are other indicators, indexes, of inflation, you know, the PCE, personal consumption expenditures, and the GDP deflator. There's different, you know, indicators, but we're talking about the CPI indicator, which is really a cost of living, aka inflation, that just came out today. Okay, let's look at it, at the CPI, CPI-U for urban. The headline, the number is 6.8%. Year over year. Now, what does that mean? That means we're taking November of this year, 2021, and comparing it to November of last year. And those 12 months. That's the base year, November of last year. And I can get different numbers by just changing the base year. But anyway, you know, typically it reports year on year here, as well as month to month. And it's kind of annualizing the month to month here. You know, how much has inflation changed from previous month, October? And then you annualize that. You do it by 12 months, and that's the 6.8% figure that you get. Now, that's up from the previous month, October, which I think was 6.3%. I may be a tenth off there. So, you know, we got to steady climb here going on in the headline. Well, what do we mean by headline? Headline is food and energy costs inflation on top of all the rest. All the rest is called the core inflation rate. Headline is when you throw in, you know, energy meaning gasoline and home heating oil mostly, on top of the core meaning everything else, all other goods and services. And, of course, food on top of that. Now, if you look at the report that just came out, the big items responsible for the bulk of the 6.8% are food, gasoline, and shelter. And to some extent, used cars and clothing. Those are the big contributors to the 6.8%. Now, why is it important to identify, you know, the breakout? What's responsible for the 6.8%? Because it throws some light on this question. Is this due to supply problems, particularly global supply chain problems, inflation due to that mostly? Or is it due to other factors? That's a big debate, right? The Federal Reserve has been saying, oh, it's going to be temporary because it's a supply chain problem, global supply chain, right? In other words, shipping the stuff to U.S. ports, particularly from Asia to L.A., the L.A. port, where most of the Asian goods, discrete things, come into the U.S., right? So goods inflation versus services inflation. you know, services is everything else. You know, services is, you know, your utilities that you get. Services have to do with education, have to do with medical care, even government services. You know, has to do with your utilities that you pay for, personal things, you know, like haircuts and dry cleaning and you know, beauty parlors, all that kind of stuff, restaurants, etc. That's all personal services, right? But there are other services involved as well, like lodging and hotels and entertainment. And all. Look, services constitute 80% of the U.S. economy, 80. Goods, right, things that you buy, are 12%, and then construction is about another 8%. You could consider construction goods as well, perhaps. All right, so 20% of the economy is goods, things. But a vast majority are, you know, other things as services. Well, one useful way is to break out how much of that 6.8% is due to goods prices rising and how much is it due to services rising. And when you look at goods, how much of that is due to imports and global supply chain issues, and how much of that is due to domestic supply chain, there's a domestic supply chain, and, you know, domestic demand for goods. Okay, supply and demand. You know, if you have a shortage of supply, that drives up prices. If you have an increase in demand, that drives up prices, and vice versa. All right, so if most of the inflation is food and gasoline and shelters, what does this tell us as to the causes? Right. Well, most of the food is not imported. Most of the food is just produced here in the United States, especially, you know, meat and eggs and milk and things like that. So that can't be a global supply chain issue. And how much has food gone up? Well, quite a bit. Quite a bit. If you look at food, right, month on month, it increased 0.8%, or if you analyze that, 9.6%, you know, annual, almost 10%. And then the previous month, it was 0.7%. So it's gone up. Food has gone up. But it's not a global supply chain issue, right? It's either a domestic supply or a domestic demand, or it's not just supply and demand. Well, what does that mean? I thought everything was supply and demand. No. There's this thing called inflationary expectations that plays a role as well. Well, what do we mean by inflationary expectations? It simply means that prices go up because consumers think they're going up, so they go and spend more. Well, you could call that demand, but it's really a different kind of demand that has to do with, you know, psychological factors, not real factors like, oh, I got more money in my pocket, so I'm going to spend more, right? It's simply because I think prices are going to go up, so I'm going to quickly go and buy it before it goes up. We see that happen a lot with houses, right? Right? Prices go up, inflationary expectations take hold, and people say, well, I better go buy that house now or it's going to be more next month. Inflationary expectations play a role on the demand side, as I've just described, but they also play a role on the supply side. In other words, if businesses think, oh, prices are going up, why don't I get a piece of that action? If people are willing to buy more, I can raise my price. And, of course, they're doing that. We sometimes call that price gouging, right? So, to sum up here, how much of the inflation in these different categories, food, gas, shelter, cars, clothing, utilities, medical, etc., how much of this is due to supply, global chain, domestic chain? How much of this is due to demand, domestic demand? Well, you know, if you talk about food price increases, that's not a global supply problem. We don't import enough. You know, there's some fruits and stuff we sometimes import in the winter from South America, but it's a domestic issue. Well, how much of the domestic food price increase, which is significant here, last month and this month, you know, around almost 10% or more annually, how much of that is driven by global supply chain? None. Okay, so then is it a domestic problem? Is it a question of demand? People are eating more food? No, they're not eating more food. Domestic food demand hardly changes at all. So it can't be a big increase in domestic food demand, right? Well, is it a supply problem for food? Not a global chain supply issue. Was it a domestic supply problem? Well, what could that be? Well, that could be maybe a lack of truckers, you know, moving the food around. Maybe a little bit of that going on. Well, what the hell is it then? That's the big increase going on, or one of the two big increases in inflation going on. If it's not global supply, if it's very little domestic supply, if it's not domestic demand, what the hell is it? It's price gouging. It's price gouging, inflationary expectations on the part of businesses. They're raising prices because everyone else is, and they think they can. They're trying to recoup the losses from 2020. You know, the losses in revenue, profits in revenue, they're trying to make up revenue from price increases. And that's what's going on. You know, food price increases are going up. And food, by the way, is a combination of going to the grocery store and going to restaurants. Right? That's going up still, officially, now on an annual rate over 10%. I think it's higher, but it's going up, no doubt. And it's not supply, and it's not demand. It's really price gouging going on. A lot of these companies are just raising their prices because they can. And they're trying to make up their loss in revenue. It's price gouging. It's not supply and demand in a traditional sense here. It's related to inflationary expectations, but it's not traditional supply and demand. Demand's not increasing for food. We're eating the same amount we were, mostly. It's not a supply problem. Okay, but it's a big element. The 6.8%, which is called the headline inflation, compares to the core inflation. In other words, everything except food and energy, a 4.9%. So in other words, food and gasoline's the other big culprit here, are playing a big role in inflation. Well, we talked about how food is not really a supply and demand issue. What about gasoline prices, right? And to some extent, home heating prices. What about that? How much is that? Been contributing, right? We do have a problem in gasoline prices. How much did that go up last month? 6.1%. Oh, that's the big culprit here. That's the big cause of this headline 6.8%. You know, in 1 month it goes up 6%. That's a huge increase in gasoline. Well, is that a supply problem? To some extent, yes. A global supply problem? I don't know. You know? The price of global crude oil went up significantly over late summer. Why? Did supply increase or decrease so much over the summer? No. Did demand increase so much to drive up global crude oil supplies? You know, it went from like $60-something a barrel to $85 a barrel, right? Why did they raise prices so much? Was there so much increase in demand or shortage of supply? Neither. It went up because the global oil companies, OPEC and crude oil producers, and the shippers on the super tankers and the refiners, you know, and the refineries here, price gouged us. They said, oh, gee, the economy's opening. Let's jack our prices up. That's what went on and is going on to a great extent. It's not normal supply and demand. It's price gouging going on by the big oil companies. Look, the U.S. produces more crude oil than Saudi Arabia does. Yeah, we produce more crude oil here. We have plenty of supply here. Why are the prices going up? Because you've got monopolies. You've got, the big oil producers control the price. And when they think they can, they jack the price up. That's why, you know, the price of crude oil and gasoline, rather, at the pump just fluctuates by huge amounts periodically, right? It's not that supply and demand is changed by huge amounts. It never does. The problem is just simple price gouging by the oil companies. And to some extent, home heating oil as well. You know, the oil companies own much of the natural gas fields. And they manipulate the price of natural gas as well. Look, the U.S. exports oil. Exports it. It's got so much. Now, home heating energy prices have not gone up as much because the winter has not been that severe, particularly in the Northeast. So natural gas prices have been sort of languishing here. Yeah. Should some severe storms hit the eastern part of the country, you watch those natural gas prices jump, you know, maybe even, you know, go up 50% or something. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, to summarize, you got two big culprits. You got energy prices, gasoline at the pump. You've got food prices, right? Neither of them can be explained by supply and demand adequately. Both of them are the result of simple price gouging. Businesses raising prices because they can. Expectations, you know, that everyone's raising prices, we're going to do it too, right? And these are necessities that people got to continue to buy. You know, they can't cut back their consumption of food that much. You know, they can't cut back their spending on gasoline. So people go and pay those higher prices. They have to because these are necessities. And they cut back spending somewhere else. And that's what's going on. Now, there's also the problem of shelter, right? Shelter meaning home prices, new home prices, and shelter meaning rents, right? Let's take those. New home prices. New home prices going up partly because of the materials, lumber and so forth, which is part of this, we're going to raise our prices because everyone else is. And part of it is due to inflationary expectations by home buyers and therefore demand. So demand is driving some of the home price increase. But what about rents? Do we have a shortage of rents? Do we have excess demand for rents? Well, we got a lot of people being evicted, so the supply of rents, you know, are rising. What about the demand for rents? It doesn't change that much from time to time. It's a function of population and working age adults. It doesn't change that much. But the rent inflation, I think, is much higher than they're reporting. Much higher. Rents went up 0.6%, right? Food went up 0.7, or food away from home 0.8. So, you know, you're about 8 to 10% inflation going on annually here for food and for rents, and you've got a huge increase, 50% annual increase in the price of gasoline if it continues. Okay, so those three areas are the main culprits. of inflation. Neither of them can be explained by supply and demand. Just maybe a little bit, but not that much. You do have global supply chain problems here for goods, you know, goods products, discrete products, and that's reflected in auto prices going up, particularly for used cars, but new cars too, because the components, the parts, semiconductor chips and so forth, are imported goods, no doubt about it. And that's driving up the cost of cars. So there is a supply chain, global supply chain problem, driving up transport costs for cars and used cars. Also, you can see the supply, global supply chain problem reflected in the price of apparel or clothing, most of which is imported. That's going up as well. Okay, so there is some global supply problems built into these inflation numbers. But a lot of it is not supply, and it's not even demand. Food, gas, shelter. Another example that is not really supply or demand domestically here is look at your utility prices, you know, electricity and gas. That's not a supply problem. I mean, that changes very little. Seasonally, it changes, but, you know, these numbers I'm giving you are adjusted for seasonality. But yet we have rising electricity and gas. Well, why? Because they can. They know it. And, you know, the utility companies are gouging us. Prices going up 10% or more for gas and electricity. It's another example of this widespread psychological perspective going on amongst the business community of, well, prices are going up, we better raise ours too. It's related to what's called inflationary expectations. Okay. Now, I think the numbers are even higher than they're talking about. Why? Well, you got to understand that the CPI is composed of about 450 items. They call this the basket of goods and services. And those items are given certain weights. In other words, shelter, lodging, and food and gasoline are given greater weights because they constitute a bigger part of one or a family's budget. Right? So to get a true reflection of the impact of inflation, you got to weight those items that people spend more on more than items that they don't spend as much on. I mean, people just don't buy that many laptop computers, you know, which is in the basket of goods, right, in a given years, but they spend a lot on food, and they spend a lot on rents and so forth. So you got to give those items more weight. Now, I think the problem is that the weights are outmoded. Those weights were determined in pre-COVID. I think the weights of the cost of living for an average family, median family, are worse than they were. Worse meaning they really reflect greater impact of inflation on household budgets than they were pre-COVID. This is another example of how COVID has structurally, fundamentally changed the economy. So the weights are for the big items, food and shelter, are insufficient. They should be given more weight, especially for the median families, you know, those making 50, 60,000 and below annual income. The weights for shelter and so forth should be changed, increased for the basics in the CPI, but they're not. They're still pre-COVID, right? And what that means is that inflation is really higher than it's being reported. This is 6.8%. Right? Headline inflation, CPI, U. I think should be higher. I think inflation is really 10% or more, maybe slightly more than 10. It's around 10%. It's not 6.8. It's actually higher. If we had weights that correctly reflected, the cost of living and how it's changed for median and below families, right? I mean, the weights now are not only just pre-COVID, the weights now are averages for all households and all income levels, right? But rising food has not impacted, families that make $200,000 a year or more. It hasn't affected them as much as it's affected somebody making $40,000. So the weights, should be broken down by income group, not just an average, and they should be adjusted from pre-COVID to a post-COVID economy, but they're not. There's other problems as well. Like I really, really think the rent inflation number is grossly underestimated. You know, the rent component here last month went up 0.6% or 7% annually, roughly. Right? Do you really think rents have gone up only 7%? I don't. I think rents have gone up a hell of a lot more than 7%. Plus, in some of the indices, inflation indices, the government lowers the actual rent number by assuming that, get this, homeowners pay themselves a rent. That's called imputed rents. You know, there's about 50 million actual rent units, people who are renting, and there's about 50 million homeowners with mortgages. And what imputed rents means is that what they're doing is assuming homeowners pay themselves rent at only a 2% rate, annual rate, only 2%. Well, it's a phony number to begin with, but it's a phony low number. And when you take that phony low number for half, 50 million, and you add it to 50 million renters who are, maybe their rents went up 20%, well, the average you get is much lower. You see, they lowball by adding imputed rents for homeowners to the actual rents for real renters to get a lower number. There's a lot of games like that played with the statistics, both the job statistics and the price statistics in the Labor Department. Another game is lowering actual prices based on quality improvements. You know, if the price of your iPhone went from $600 to $1,000, roughly, which it did, right? Oh, the government, Labor Department says, oh, but, you know, the quality, what you're getting is so much more for the $1,000 that we're going to say iPhone prices actually decreased. Well, you're paying $1,000, not $600. But the government is saying, oh, it's really $500. You see, that's called the quality adjustment in the prices. It's another statistic, just like seasonality adjustments. Right? It's they say, okay, government says, okay, you know, we expect prices to go up here in the winter right before the holidays anyway. So we're going to make a downward adjustment. You know, we're going to make a seasonality adjustment to remove the fluctuations here, dampen the fluctuations that always occur at the end of the year. Right? Well, this year, you know, the fluctuation really occurred in September. People went out and bought stuff early. Usually it was October, November for Christmas, right? They did it early. But the government is still assuming that you're going to have big increases here in November, December in prices. That's another problem of how the structure has changed in the economy. But the point is, you got seasonality adjustments. Whether you're doing seasonality adjustments or whether you're doing a quality of goods adjustments, downward adjustments, or whether you're doing imputed rents and all this. These are statistical operations on the actual raw price increases. What you got is statistics, not data, not raw data. And these statistics play a role, I believe, in dampening the actual inflation numbers, smoothing them out, dampening them. Another example of that is the government has moved to what's called chain price indexes, chain prices, which averages on averages, basically. I won't get into the technicality, and therefore smooths out and dampens the fluctuation even more. There's a lot of these statistical operations with a lot of assumptions in them that may be wrong, that in the end dampen and lower the actual inflation numbers. That's going on all the time, you see. We got the same phenomenon going on in reporting unemployment and employment numbers. But anyway, you got to keep that in mind, that a lot of the methodologies going on in the Labor Department really underestimate inflation. That's the point that I want to make. Second main point that I've made is that it's partly import global supply problems when you're talking about cars and clothing. It's maybe a little percent of domestic supply transporting this stuff around. You know, we have a lack of truckers. Why do we have a lack of truckers? Well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that the real wages of truck drivers has declined by a third in recent decades. People don't want to go into driving trucks, you know. Who wants to go into an industry where, the wages are actually falling? Well, now they're going to have to raise, and they are raising wages for truck drivers because they can't get them. Okay, so, we got some supply-side import inflation going on, no doubt about that. You can see that in autos and clothing and electronic goods. Yeah. We got maybe a little bit of domestic supply issue in transport going on. We don't have a domestic supply problem for goods, food goods in particular. We got price gouging going on, right? We got super price gouging going on by the oil companies for gasoline prices. That's a big culprit. We got some price gouging going on in lodging and rents, right? As the rents open up, landlords, particularly the industrial landlords, they're gouging. They're really raising prices up, because they were frozen pretty much from raising rent prices during the worst part of the COVID. Now they want to make up the loss, and now they're jacking up rents. Right. So rents are rising higher because of gouging. Gas is rising higher because of gouging. To some extent, food. But this has nothing to do with demand, because people got so much money in their pockets because of the stimulus bill of last March. You see, you got Republicans and business interests in their media saying, oh, we gave people too much money. That's why they're not coming back to work. Oh, we gave them too much unemployment benefits. That's why they're not coming back to work. Well, even when they cut the unemployment benefits off, they're still not coming back to work. So the end of that argument. But they got too much money in their pocket. American consumers, workers got too much money. Yeah. Therefore, we shouldn't give them any more. Therefore, let's stop this Build Back Better bill here, which gives households more. That's the argument. You see, it's the argument, the demand side argument for inflation is really the argument of the Republicans and business interests to stymie, thwart, prevent any further government social spending programs. That's what that argument is. But that argument has little to do with the inflation, as we've been describing. It's partly, inflation's partly, once again, to repeat, global supply for goods, some goods, right? But it's mostly some domestic supply from transport and price gouging by businesses. especially the oil companies, right? Yeah, that's really what inflation's being driven by. You know, what I'm saying is the truth is in the details. You gotta unpack these numbers. You just can't believe these numbers because there's a lot of statistical ledger domain going on, right? You gotta unpack it from that. And you gotta look at supply and demand. And then, you know, look at the world is not just supply and demand. The world, you know, is monopoly pricing and exploitation and price gouging. That's the main thing. And you can see it clearly with the oil companies and some food companies and, big companies that own, millions of rental units. You can see it there. It's price gouging, right? To some extent, maybe inflationary expectations. But inflationary expectations on the demand side are not income related. In other words, inflationary expectations occur on the demand side irrespective of how much income you've got, right? That's why it's called inflationary expectations. Prices are rising, so I'm going to go buy because prices are rising. Has nothing to do with whether I got more income in my pocket. You know, most of the March American Rescue Plan, which was about 1.3 trillion, not 2.3, as reported. I've talked about that before. You know, the 1.3 is really the unemployment benefits, the checks given to people, and the money given to small businesses and grants. That was like 1.3 trillion spent. That's been spent. That's dissipated by August. And this inflation surge is really a late September, October, November phenomenon here. That money has been dissipated. You know, well, okay, if it was 2.3 and only 1.3 was actually given to workers and small businesses, where did the other trillion go? Well, it was given to the Fed to loan to businesses, but businesses didn't take out the loans from the Fed. They didn't need it, you see. They were fat with cash, big businesses. So they never borrowed it. So the Fed gave the money back to the Treasury. Yeah. So the stimulus bill of earlier this year in March was only $1.3 trillion, and that's been spent pretty much for this year. Right? So that's demand. If demand has been spent, you know, where is it? It's not here. It's not contributing significantly to the surge in inflation in the last 2 or 3 months because it's already been spent by the end of the summer. So it's not demand. So it must be supply or price gouging if it's not demand. And that's what I've been describing, right? It's a combination of supply, especially global supply chains in certain categories like cars and clothing and electronic goods. Yeah, that's a global supply problem. A little bit of domestic supply because they can't get truck drivers to move the stuff around domestically. That's a supply issue, okay? But the output of, food and, other domestic goods has not declined. It's not declined. So it's not a general supply problem here in the U.S., the transport supply, right? And that leaves the only other explanation, inflationary expectations and price gouging. And that's, in my opinion, the primary cause of what's going on. It's price gouging, inflationary expectations on the part of business, to a lesser extent on the part of the consumers. That's the cause of this inflation. And it's not going to be transitory, as the Fed thinks. It's going to continue. You know, it maybe won't continue at the 10% plus rate every month, but it's going to be a chronic problem that's not going away. And by the way, that chronic problem of not going away is going to really give the Democratic Party the coup de grace here come next November election. They're going to lose big time, I predict, in the House. The House is going to go Republican. partly also because of all the voter suppression gerrymandering going on in the Republican red states. Boy, they are locking up those states, right? 20, 25 to 30 of them are going to be locked up solid. I mean, you can run Mickey Mouse and he'll win as a Republican candidate because of the way they're locking up. And, you know, they're making sure that any of these local officials here that have anything to do with the election calculation of votes and so forth are going to be Trump supporters. They are purging even Republicans, independent Republicans, secretaries of state and whoever in the states that manage the voting process. They're purging them. They're getting rid of them. And of course, even at the county level, and especially in those Democratic counties in the South, Georgia and places like that, they're getting rid of these people. They're putting in their own Trump supporters to make sure this next election goes to the Republicans. So there's some of that going on. But there's also public opinion, that is really disappointed in the Biden administration, and rightfully so. Biden has not been able to get through the programs, partly because of his refusal to do anything about the filibuster, but also because, the Democrats slim majorities, and now we see clearly that some of the Democrats are really Republicans in sheep's clothing, Manchin, Sinema, and so forth, and they're preventing the passage of further stimulus. So that's another reason people are disappointed. They're disappointed, too, because of the lack of real police reform that's been promised, or a real immigration reform. In other words, the promises that Biden made and the Democrats made in the election here last year are far from being fulfilled, and it looks like a lot of them are dead on arrival. And people know that. People know that. And you overlay inflation on top of it, and boy, that's the formula. And you overlay, the gerrymandering and the voter suppression, and that's just the icing on the cake. And the Republicans are going to do a big sweep here. And then right back where we were with the Trump. Right back, doesn't look good. Democracy does not look good in this country going forward. And the economy, of course, I believe is not all that good. We've got some growth because of the reopening of the economy. That's going to dissipate, I believe, just as inflation is going to continue to be a chronic issue. Okay, that's my analysis here. Causes of inflation, just to sum up, some global supply chain, some domestic transport supply chain issues, but mostly inflationary expectations by businesses as well as consumers, and price gouging. That explains what's going on. And these numbers from the CPI are underestimated lowball numbers. It's really over 10%, especially if you're median or below income families. It's really well over 10%. It's mostly food, gas, shelter, and used cars. And the rest is, a lot of it is just price gouging. Well, it's price gouging and oil companies and gas and so forth. Okay. So we'll see if this continues. What the Fed is going to do is going to raise interest rates. If this chronically continues, which it will, and Fed raising interest rates is going to slow down the real economy even more starting next year. So that lack of robust recovery in 2022 and chronic inflation and gerrymandering and voter suppression all come together, and the lack of the Biden administration being aggressive on any of these fronts, all that is a formula, I think, for a vast defeat for the Democrats come 2022. Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about another issue politically, and it's more of a global issue here, and that is, what the hell's going on with the heating up of this Ukraine issue, right? big issue here. What's going on? Well, you know, you do have Putin and the Russians amassing military forces on the border of Ukraine. I mean, that's going on. I mean, you got photos of that. That's going on. Well, why is it going on? Well, because very clearly, the Russians believe that there is a move underway by the U.S. To deepen its involvement in the Ukraine by providing more state-of-the-art military weapons for the Ukraine. And U.S. Advisors on more bases in the Ukraine, on the Russian-Ukraine border. That's going on. And the Russians are paranoid about the U.S. allowing the Ukraine to become part of NATO. Because if it becomes part of NATO, if you know, there is any attempt to bring back Ukraine into the Russian fold, well, the U.S. has to. It's required by its agreement with NATO to come to the military defense of the Ukraine. Right now, it's the U.S. Providing state-of-the-art military weapons to Ukraine, which has got the Russians nervous. But there's a lot of talk about bringing the Ukraine into NATO. Well, the U.S. already brought the Baltic countries, you know, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and, of course, Romania and so forth, into NATO, right, on the Russian front, when they had promised not to do so in the 90s. The U.S. has done so. And it's really got, you know, the Russians surrounded now. NATO is marched east, and it's, you know, squeezing even further. And at one point, you know, the U.S. backed Georgia, the country invading part of Russia, and Russians responded back and threw them out and took some of Georgia territory. So, you know, the Russians have been invaded, and talking about invasions, you know, the Ukraine is, but Russians always considered, you know, part of Russia, and you can make that argument. You know, the Russians fought this terrible war against the Nazis, most of it occurring on Ukraine territory. Millions and millions of Russians died to defend the Ukraine. And, you know, look at it from the Russian perspective. You know, if they allow the Ukraine to become part of NATO and dominated by the U.S., well, that's like saying, okay, we're going to let some other country, quote, take over the Ukraine without a shot when we fought this terrible war to prevent that, you know, back in the 1940s. The Russians and Putin are not going to do that. They're not going to allow the Ukraine to become part of NATO. That's why it's this key issue. But you got some of the countries in the Ukraine, the Baltics and Poland, stirring the pot, saying, yes, they have to be part of NATO. Because by stirring the pot, you know, it causes these regional crises like we're seeing right now. Therefore, these countries get more military aid and support from the United States. It's a way of getting more money from the U.S., you know. So what we have here is a crisis that is the product of the U.S. Managing a coup back in 2014, which is what the U.S. did. You know, the Secretary of State and the Secretary there, Virginia Nuland, who was responsible for that area, bragged that the U.S. had spent $5 billion to pull off the coup, and we won. You know, it's almost a verbatim thing. Very clearly, the U.S. did that, made sure that, you know, the government of Ukraine was not pro-Russia, pulled it out of the Russia orbit there, and it was a kind of a coup in which the U.S. used these, you know, proto-fascist forces on the ground to do that. Well, it's been kind of a, stasis since 2014. But now the push in the West and the U.S., some U.S. interest is to provide them more up-to-date military effort support and to bring them into NATO. Well, Russia's not going to allow that to happen. No. Russia will invade, no doubt about it, if it looks like they're going to be part of NATO. Well, there's discussions going on now between Putin and Biden, right? I don't think Biden wants a war in the Ukraine to suck the U.S. in. I mean, it'd be pretty stupid. You know, the lines of logistics of the U.S. are long, and it's right next door for the Russians. That's not a good military strategy to undertake, to go into a conflict with long lines of communication like that. I mean, the Russians have, 175,000 troops on the border. For the U.S. to put U.S. troops in, it would need anywhere near that. It would need a fleet of 500 C-135 transports to bring U.S. Forces and supplies to match the Russians. And by then, it would be all over, you see. So I believe Biden knows this. Biden does not want a conflict over there. But he's getting pushed by other forces in NATO, in the Baltics and so forth, Poland. He wants sort of a truce. Let's just keep the status quo as it has been from 2014. But Putin says, stop this NATO thing, and maybe we can do that. Biden's more concerned about China. You know, he doesn't want to have a fight over the Ukraine when he's already committed to a fight over Taiwan, you see. You know, it's a two-front war, right? And it's a bad logistics two-front war, you know. I mean, go read your Clausewitz, and you'll see that you should never go to war with those such lines of communication and supply. In any event, the U.S. is more concerned about China and less concerned about Ukraine. But they're in a hornet's nest over there in Ukraine, and they can't get out of it. Biden can't get out of it. He's trying to look for a formula to sort of stabilize it. So the U.S. can turn to its real objective, which is containing and putting pressure on China. We're moving, drifting. The radical right would have us go into a two-front war here over Taiwan and Ukraine if they could do it. And maybe if they come back in power in 24, they'll do that. Meanwhile, we're fighting a third front war, and that's nature's war against us. You see, nature has declared war on us. The viruses that aren't stopping, the climate change and global warming, the droughts, the storms, and so forth. This is nature fighting back to the destruction that we've wrought on the natural environment, I believe. And you know, we can't even put together financing of this war, which would be, alternative energy and doing something about climate change. We can't even do that. So the U.S. is facing a three-front war, possibly, in the coming years ahead to do that. But anyway, that's just my commentary on some of the global political strategic developments going on in Ukraine and China and climate change. Okay, I think that's it. We're out of time. That's it. I'm out of here.